from West Virginia Public Broadcasting.
Support for the legislature today is provided by the following.
The West Virginia Higher Education Policy Commission, working with students and families to improve college access and student success for a better West Virginia.
Good evening. I'm Andrea Lanham for the Legislature Today. Activity is ramping up here at the Capitol in Charleston. Education bills are making their way through committees, and we'll get the update as the House Education Chairman, Delegate Paul Espinoza, joins us in just a few minutes. But first, the session's focus on the opioid epidemic continues. Today, members of the West Virginia Association of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse Counselors gathered under the dome. Russ Barber captured their message.
I'm Jim Barry. I'm an addiction psychiatrist. To give you some perspective, in 2015, we were at 44.5 per 100,000 people, citizens of West Virginia, who died from overdose. That led the nation. We've led the nation every year, folks, every year, and we surpass the previous year's records.
I am Mary Eldred Crouch, and I am the current president of the West Virginia Association of Alcoholism and Drug Abuse Counselors. WAVADAC, as we're known, is here today primarily to address the stigma around the disease of addiction and to try to talk with the public and with our legislators about effective treatment, barriers to treatment, and let folks know that there is hope, there is help, so that we can begin to stem the tide of this epidemic that we're currently experiencing with opioid death.
Brandy Haynes, you know, I graduated valedictorian of my class in 1998. I had a full paid scholarship to anywhere I wanted to go. I had a car accident, subsequent doctor appointments, you know, pain medication, and it just went on from there. I have October the 5th made a year in recovery, so, and I'm now back in college to be a substance abuse counselor. Recovery is possible.
Joining me now, Delegate Paul Espinoza, Chair of the House Education Committee. Chairman Espinoza, thank you so much for joining me this evening.
Good to be with you, Andrea.
So your Education Committee has myriad issues and bills under consideration, but let's continue for just a moment about the session's focus on drug addiction and the opioid crisis in general. How has this epidemic impacted West Virginia's education system, and what are you hearing from educators, most importantly about student health and achievement?
Well, unfortunately, the opioid addiction and other substance abuse issues impact all aspects of life in West Virginia, and you know our schools are not immune to it. Clearly, I believe in order to address this issue, it takes a multi-pronged approach, and education certainly is a key aspect of that. Was very pleased that we were able to enact legislation last session that does require a comprehensive substance abuse curriculum, age appropriate, to be offered in each of our public schools. That was a piece of legislation we worked very closely with the Attorney General's office on to, again, just make sure that we are doing all that we can to educate our children about the perils of substance abuse, particularly the issues with opioids. Really commend the committee that we have that's been established last session on substance abuse that's, you know, again, looking at all aspects of this issue to make sure that we do have the tools in place in order to effectively combat this scourge on our state.
So moving on to specific legislation right now, your committee passed House Joint Resolution 103 last week dealing with the election of school board members. A few concerns were voiced by Democrats and advocacy groups that the proposal would politicize the office and that races would be too expensive for educators. Another concern is the legislature would have control over the curriculum. What's your response to some of these concerns?
Well, a little perplexed that this has become a political issue here at the legislature. Last year, you may recall, House Joint Resolution 24, which essentially is identical to House Joint Resolution 103 that passed House Education last week. again, passed unanimously on a bipartisan basis, essentially that resolution would do two things. One, of course, it would call for the election in a manner prescribed by law of six of the nine voting members of the state school board. I think what we hear often from our constituents is that they would like a greater say into who serves on their school board. And again, six of the nine would be elected under that proposed resolution. Three would continue to be appointed by the governor. And again, it would be in a manner prescribed by law. I certainly would advocate for making those districts as small as possible to, again, make those races easier to compete in. I certainly agree that if those are statewide races or even races defined by congressional district, those would be significant races, very expensive races to run in. We looked at, I think the model that I certainly would support, something similar to Ohio, where they have their school board districts are equal to about two senatorial districts. I think there is an opportunity, if this resolution passes through both houses of the legislature, if it is ratified by West Virginia voters, the legislature would then be called upon to basically define how those seats, would be elected. I certainly would advocate for smaller rather than larger districts in order to keep the cost down. The other aspect of a House joint resolution that I think is equally important, and certainly it's been a topic of discussion here in the legislature for decades, is what role does the legislature have in reviewing rules that are promulgated by the State Board of Education and the Department of Education? As you may be aware, virtually all other rules of state government, all other agencies, including higher education, submit their rules for approval to the legislature. That is not the case with our public education rules. You'll recall Heckler versus the Board of Education pretty much confirmed that our state constitution does not require the state board to submit their rules for approval. This would simply bring those rules under the same review process and approval process that virtually every other agency of state government currently follows.
So six would be elected, but three are appointed. Why leave it to three to be appointed?
Well, I think that was a matter of just a discussion. I know as we had discussions last session, that's what passed out of House Education last year. And again, this House Joint Resolution 103, essentially identical to what passed out of House Education. I think the only change is the term of the office. Currently, of course, our state school board members serve nine-year terms under this proposed resolution. That would be reduced to six, which I think was something that we heard from members. I think there is a desire, again, to give the governor an opportunity to, have some input into, what members are on the state school board. But again, by allowing six of the nine to be elected, we feel that will make those school board members more accountable to our districts. And I think something that I certainly support is, again, making those districts located around the state so that you ensure representation from each area of the state. In the Eastern Panhandle, for example, where the district that I represent is located, it's been a little bit hit and miss as to whether we've had representation on the state school board. We've actually gone significant periods of time without representation. I think that would help ensure, if we draw up the districts as I would advocate, make sure we have representation from around the state while still allowing the governor the opportunity to appoint three.
Last week on the Senate floor, Senator Ejeta called the 1% proposed teacher pay raise a slap in the teachers' faces. One of his points is that PEIA benefits have been eroded and would basically take up any of the money that would be left from this pay raise. Is a 1% pay raise the best we can do for teachers this year?
Well, I share the concern that, as you look at our state employees, including teachers who have not had significant pay raises in the last few years, really any pay raises in the last few years. It's been several years, of course, since our educators and our school service personnel have received raises. I certainly support trying to provide them more equitable pay. I mean, over in the Eastern Panhandle, for example, we see a tremendous disparity between what our teachers are paid and what they're paid in surrounding states. So certainly recognize that's a challenge, but I certainly understand that we have to keep our overall budget within the revenue estimates that the governor's provided. The governor's provided a revenue estimate of about $4.3 billion. So while I do think there's broad support for perhaps trying to improve upon that 1% pay raise that the governor's proposed, it'll certainly have to be done within the overall budget. And I think that's going to be the challenge before us. But I do think that there is support for trying to make our teacher and school service personnel and other state employees' salaries as competitive as we can.
Moving to charter schools, do we have money to take away from public education to develop charter schools? The Senate president has sponsored a bill that would create charter schools, and what he has in mind is creating a charter school for STEM fields, so science, technology, engineering, and mathematics. Is there an appetite in the House for taking up charter schools at all?
I haven't had an opportunity to view Senator Carmichael's proposed bill. In the past, I have been an advocate for public charter schools, which, again, would not take money out of our public school system, but would allow additional flexibility for communities and other organizations that do perhaps want to form a school such as a STEM school. I have been an advocate for expanded parental choice and I've sponsored and have supported public charter school legislation in the past. Whether there's support for that this session, I haven't gotten a really good sense, at least on the House side, for support of that legislation. It's not one of the bills that's on our agenda to be run this year, but certainly to the extent that some type of a public charter school model could be used to help preserve our community schools, I certainly would support that, but. It doesn't appear to be a great deal of support for that in the House this year.
The governor mentioned in his State of the State address a 13th year of public education, and also we know that there is a push to establish a scholarship for community and technical students, much like the Promise Scholarship for students attending four-year universities. Can you describe the difference in what's being considered in the House and what's being considered at the Senate at this point?
Well, as you may be aware, quite often over the last few years under Republican leadership, we've tried to divide the responsibilities for running various parts of the legislation, and the governor's bill regarding trying to expand accessibility for our two-year institutions and the 13th year for high school students. That is a bill, of course, it's being taken up by the Senate, and that's the approach we'll take with that bill, is to basically allow the Senate to kind of refine that legislation, and then once if in fact it does pass out of the Senate, then the House, of course, will take that up. I think there is broad support in the House, bipartisan support for expanding accessibility of our two-year institutions. I think it's clear that we need to do everything we can to help ensure that we have a qualified workforce who can assume the roles that we're hoping to attract from job creators who will be locating in our state. I think the question is exactly how you do that, and I think there's, as I understand it, and again I haven't followed it real closely yet, but certainly there are questions: is the $7 million figure that the governor has placed in the budget, is that really an accurate figure? And I think I'm looking forward to seeing how the Senate deals with that, whether they do in fact feel that is a realistic figure. And then I think if it does make its way over to the House, I think there'll be ample opportunity for us to ask questions and again just ensure that the proposal, which again I think we support the concept, but just to make sure that it's workable and that it does attract people to attend our two-year institutions for the right reasons, to gain the type of skill sets that they need in order to be a productive member of our workforce.
Delegate Espinoza, we only have a few minutes left. Any final thoughts on your focus on the committee as we begin a second full week of the session?
Well, Andrea, if you look at the last couple of years, a big part of our focus of the House Education Committee, and I think the legislature as a whole, has been, to try to move away from a one-size-fits-all approach. And really trying to empower our local school districts to make more decisions closer to the classroom. We obviously enacted significant higher education reform last year that did go a long way to providing additional autonomy and flexibility for our higher education institutions. And this session, we're doing much the same with House Bill 4006 that deals with trying to empower our local principals and teachers to decide what type of professional development they need. Again, it's all geared toward and consistent with providing additional flexibility for our local school districts.
Delegate Paul Espinoza, thank you so much for being here tonight.
Good to be with you.
Next this evening, the story of an organization tackling a very big problem. People are leaving West Virginia at an alarming rate. In the past year, more than 15,000 people left the state, or about 41 people per day. West Virginia Public Broadcasting explored this issue last year in our Inside Appalachia series called Struggle to Stay. We heard from people who wanted to stay but didn't know if it was feasible, and others who wanted to leave to find opportunities elsewhere. This trend is putting a strain on local businesses, making it tough for employers to find skilled, educated workers. Roxy Todd reports.
Inside a renovated building in downtown Huntington, about 20 people are at their laptops in a sunlit office without any cubicles. On long tables, senior web developers sit shoulder to shoulder with new employees. Balloons linger around one seat, leftover remnants of an employee's birthday last week. It's in this office where we find Jacob Howell.
Back in December, I was graduating in May, and I really didn't know where I was going to end up. I didn't know if I'd be looking out of state. I didn't know if there'd be something around here to do.
Jacob Howell is 22. He grew up in Hurricane and graduated from Marshall University last year with a degree in computer information and game design. He says he wanted to stay in West Virginia, but he didn't know if he would find a job.
And the tech field, it seems like there's not a lot of options here.
But then Howell heard about a fellowship program specifically designed to attract and retain young workers. It was launched by Generation West Virginia, a nonprofit that seeks to build a talent pipeline for West Virginia companies. The program is called Impact West Virginia. The companies that host the fellows agree to pay their salaries for a year as sort of a trial run at a professional job for qualified workers. Howell was selected to work here at Core 10, a technology company that develops software for clients in the financial services industry. The company is based out of Nashville, but it recently set up this new office in Huntington. Last year, there was an increase in homicides in Huntington, and Cabell County had the highest number of drug overdose deaths in West Virginia. Despite these statistics, Howell says he's committed to staying here.
If you just run from those problems, if you just turn to easier places or turn to places that you think don't have problems when most places do have similar issues, it's just going to become a cycle and more people are going to leave and those problems will just get worse.
Howell is one of seven fellows selected by Generation West Virginia, which launched Impact West Virginia in September 2017. Natalie Roper is the nonprofit's executive director.
Young people are motivated to live in communities where they can really have an impact. They want to live in places they feel a part of and invested in and be a part of defining that place's future.
But the challenge, she says, is connecting those young people who want to make change in West Virginia with jobs that pay well and help them grow their careers.
West Virginia loses too many young people to opportunities outside the state. And these trends limit our tax base, they threaten our local capacity, and threaten our ability to attract new employers to the state. So in other words, we see attracting and retaining young talent as the economic development strategy for West Virginia.
Countless other groups have tried to keep young workers here by offering them training opportunities or volunteer gigs, like AmeriCorps. But most of these projects have been funded through the federal government or philanthropic foundations. Roper wanted to try something different by partnering with private companies.
We were hearing from employers that they were struggling to find qualified people to fill open positions, while we were hearing from young people that they were struggling to find quality jobs that would allow them to stay in West Virginia.
One of Impact West Virginia's partners is Downstream Strategies, an environmental consulting company based in Morgantown. The work they do, mostly scientific research, requires advanced training, and finding the right workers has been a challenge. Mark Glass is one of the company's owners.
Yeah, I think we haven't had a hard time necessarily recruiting people from outside the state, but I do think we've had some challenges with retention, with getting people to stay here.
Glass says the fellowship has already benefited Downstream because it helped them find Sarah Cottingham.
On any given day, I can be working on something different, and I really enjoy that.
Cottingham has a Master's of Science degree in community planning, and she arrived on the job with experience helping communities boost their economies through tourism. She applied for this fellowship because she wanted to work at Downstream. She's not a West Virginia native, but she's lived here for 4 years and says she loves it.
It helps that all of the things that I like are available here. So mountains, outdoor sports, old-time music, a lot of art. Those were things that initially endeared the state to me.
As part of her job, Cottingham's helped four towns in the Mountain State study the potential for attracting tourists. And as part of the fellowship, she and the other six fellows volunteer with a West Virginia nonprofit every Friday to help them network with other organizations and give back to the state. So far, she's helped two groups, Philanthropy West Virginia and the Tamarack Foundation, doing economic research and writing grants.
That's something special that, you know, you don't often get a job where you get a dedicated day a week to do community service.
Cottingham is hoping to be hired by Downstream Strategies or another West Virginia company when the fellowship ends. She says she wants to stay here and is even considering buying a house.
One of the things I really love about West Virginia is that it's possible to, as a young person, move here and make a difference. Move here and find a community. Move here and buy a house. Those are all things that in Austin, Texas, where I come from, I could never afford to buy a house. So those are things that make West Virginia a place that I view as someplace that I could stay long-term and put down roots.
Generation West Virginia plans to expand its Impact Fellowship program next year to include a larger group of young professionals and more host companies. For the Legislature Today, I'm Roxy Todd.
We'll follow up on this issue tomorrow night when we're joined by the director of the West Virginia University Bureau for Business and Economic Research. We hope you'll join us. Finally tonight, the West Virginia House of Delegates passed a bill today that would create 100 single-member legislative districts following the 2020 census, but not before an hour-long debate. Dave Mistich reports.
Democratic Delegate Barbara Fleshauer kicked off discussion by saying the bill may conflict with the state's constitution.
And those two provisions spell out how we are supposed to do redistricting or reapportionment. They, what the 100-member single-member district doesn't do is it doesn't take into account, and it does not even mention anywhere, counties. And one of the things that when our drafters did this, they set up a specific system, a method for doing apportionment.
Fleshauer also argued that single-member districts would make it more difficult to elect women and minorities, saying that multi-member districts allow for more diverse representation. Many Republicans, including Delegate Riley Moore, argued that single-member districts allow for more fair representation of constituents.
I would challenge the idea that we're living up to the spirit of that constitutional principle of one man, one vote with multi-member districts. And I don't think that we are living up to the spirit of that and that constitutional principle currently. It's certainly arguable that single-member districts being more equitable, more fair in terms of representation, and also more fair to the constituents that are served by a single member as opposed to a multi-member district.
While some Democrats argue the bill prioritizes election of members over other issues facing the state, others called for ways to ensure a fair redistricting process. Delegate Mike Pushkin proposed an amendment in the House Judiciary Committee last week that called for an independent commission on redistricting. That amendment failed, but has brought attention to another bill, House Bill 2383, which calls for a joint committee of the legislature to study and propose a fair plan for the redistricting process. That measure was referred to a subcommittee. Pushkin says he would support single-member districts, but wants to ensure gerrymandering and discrimination are kept out of the redistricting process.
I think if that's truly what our intentions are, is good government, accessibility, practicality, then I think we're putting the cart before the horse on this. What's more important to me than how many districts we have is who's drawing the districts.
Delegate Kelly Sabonia, a Republican who comes from a single-member district herself, argued that giving constituents multiple votes for multiple members creates an imbalance of power and gives some citizens more say than others.
So how in the world can we, with a straight face, say that people in Cabell County, some people only deserve one voice at the legislature, some people deserve two voices at the legislature, and some people deserve three voices at the legislature. And if you're in a four-member district, they deserve four voices at the legislature. It's a disparity that the legislature has created.
Not the
Delegate Brent Boggs also voted in favor of the bill. However, he did call for an independent commission, as Pushkin described. He cited his own experience leading the last legislative redistricting committee.
I believe I'm probably the only person in this body that has chaired a redistricting committee. And I want to tell you, if you want to make everybody mad, that's the best way to do it. Trust me. It doesn't matter if they're a Democrat or Republican, independent, no matter whatever, you're going to make somebody mad, whether they're in your party or not.
House Bill 4002 passed on a 72-25 vote and now heads to the Senate. The fate of House Bill 2383 remains in question, though, as an independent non-legislative commission has yet to make its way into the bill, and it's uncertain if it will make it to the floor. For the Legislature Today, I'm Dave Mistich in the House.
And that's our look at the Legislature Today. We'll continue to follow the action here, and we hope you'll continue to join us every evening at 6. I'm Andrea Lanham for West Virginia Public Broadcasting. Have a great evening. Thank you.